Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil computer services, and the shows are archived about a year back. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with Deborah Tang from St. Elizabeth's Shelter and a couple of other people about the homelessness situation in Santa Fe. I'd like to now welcome Douglas Preston. He's joining us by phone. He's the author of 5 nonfiction books and 13 novels, including his latest, Blasphemy. He will be speaking at Collected Works Bookstore tomorrow, Tuesday, January 15th, at 5:30 in the afternoon. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
It's great to be here.
So this is a thriller set here in the Southwest in which you've got particle physicists, Washington power brokers, Navajo people, Christian preachers, and all of them are interweaving into a combination of religion and science, which is quite fascinating. And I have to say, books like this drive people like me crazy because you can't read the book fast. You read it slowly, turning page by page by page. You stay up way too late. And truthfully, I don't quite know how it comes out yet, which is probably just as well. But anyway, how did you begin working with this idea of blasphemy? What is blasphemy?
Well, I had the idea about 20 years ago. I used to live in Santa Fe, and I remember I was sitting in a bar having a drink with a friend, and this idea came to me, and I started talking to her about it. She was a writer too, and she said, "Oh, Doug, that would make a great novel." So I thought about the idea for 20 years. And finally, like a wine maturing or maybe turning to vinegar, I don't know, it finally reached a point where I could write about it. It's really a novel about the clash between science and religion. And in the last few years, I've become increasingly dismayed and angry at the influence of the fundamentalist Christians on our society, our politics, and especially in our schools. And as any good novelist, I try to subvert my anger by writing about it. So this novel is really a response to those feelings.
So this is a story in which a group of extremely brainy scientists is at work on a particle accelerator in the Arizona desert. What are they trying to accomplish?
Well, it's the largest accelerator in the world. It's actually based on a real one, the Large Hadron Collider in Switzerland. And what they are doing is they're investigating the Big Bang. The accelerator produces an energy level not seen in the universe since the universe was only a millionth of a second old. And so they're really looking at the moment of creation. And they make an astounding discovery, which I don't want to spoil the book. I won't talk about it. But for various reasons, they feel they must keep this a secret. At the same time, we have a televangelist who suddenly sees that this is a marvelous issue to push on air. Here are this group of scientists. The U.S. government has spent $40 billion of our taxpayers' money to build a machine in the desert which is going to disprove Genesis. It's going to spit in the eye of God. And this is, you know, he starts railing against the accelerator, and he finds it's just a terrific issue. I mean, you know, evolution has already been done. It's been beaten to death. Well, the Big Bang Theory is it's creation without God. I mean, it's blasphemous. And here the government is spending our money to disprove the holiest book of the Old Testament. So that's his take.
And meanwhile, that televangelist has been prompted by a corrupt Washington lobbyist who's actually just using that issue to try to get back at one of his clients.
That's right. In fact, you know, there's a wonderful web here of evil and influence. And there's a lobbyist who's based on Jack Abramoff. He's a lobbyist for the Navajo tribe. He's the one who got the accelerator sited on the Navajo Indian Reservation. And, you know, it's finally succeeded. It's started up, and the Navajo tribal chairman comes to him and says, "Thank you very much. Your job is over," and cancels his contract. He's absolutely furious. He says he got the tribe, the goose that's laying the golden egg, the $6 million a year the government is paying the Navajo tribe for leasing this land, and they fired him. So he decides that he needs to to do something to get back at them, to start, you know, stir the pot a bit. And so he goes to this televangelist and says, look, why don't you start, you know, forget this evolution business. You know, the Big Bang Theory is a lot worse. So the televangelist is only too happy.
Now, when you have a lobbyist like that and you base them on Jack Abramoff, how do you make him like Abramoff, and how do you make him enough unlike him so that he's his own person?
Well, you know, that's a really good question. You know, as a novelist, you can't just make a bad person, a person who's completely odious and dislikable, and expect him to be a real human being. I mean, real people are complex. You also have to have, a certain empathy for your character. Now, you know, it's hard to have empathy for a guy like Jack Abramoff, but there was a certain point, I think, in his life, like in all of our lives, that we were idealistic, that we went, you know, he went to Washington hoping to do something, to do some good. And my lobbyist is the same way, but he got sucked into this system where the only thing that matters is power and money. And he's also a person who doesn't really believe in anything. I mean, the lobbyist and the religious people in my book are completely different in that the lobbyist believes in nothing. And my televangelist does believe, even though he's an odious character himself, does believe in certain things. So there are a lot of contrasts here between belief and non-belief. I mean, I'd like to talk a bit about the televangelist character, because he's sort of, I mean, it's hard to say this, but he's one of my favorite characters. I love the guy.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, he's a horrible human being, but I had an idea for him as a character a long time ago. I was driving cross country, was caught in a blizzard in Oklahoma. They shut down the interstate, and I ended up in a horrible motel room in Clinton, Oklahoma for 24 hours with, you know, the wind blowing 50 miles an hour outside. And I didn't know what to do. I turned on the TV set, and there is Pat Robertson telling me how much Jesus loves me and, you know, beseeching me to show my love for Jesus by sending money. Call this number, pledge. So I called the number, and I gave my, they said, what's your name? David Preston. I gave my brother's name. I gave them my brother's address, and I pledged $100 a month. Well, that amused me for about half an hour, but a few months later, my brother called me, and he said, Doug, you did this to me. And I said, what? What did I do? He said, Jesus is dunning me.
So, well, why did you do that? I mean, I can see pledging $20 in order to get on their mailing list, but that's a lot of money. Why did you do it?
Well, I was playing a joke on my brother. I mean, of course, he never paid. And so Jesus started dunning him. He started getting these letters. Well, he turned the tables and did it to me, and he pledged $1,000. So I got the royal treatment. And, you know, in the end, it wasn't funny. I mean, the letters started coming. I got my little Jesus first pin. I got the Bible. And the first letters were, you know, oh, isn't it wonderful? You know, God will, you know, Jesus will reward you 100 times for your generosity. I mean, all this, it's prosperity religion, prosperity evangelism, you know, how they tell you that you're going to get richer by believing, by giving, you know, that God's going to reward you with more money. Well, when I didn't pay my pledge, the letters got darker and darker in tone until finally they were basically telling me that I was going to go to hell if I didn't pay this money. And they were really quite frightening. I mean, the finest direct mail marketing people in the world had been hired to write these letters. And they said things like, you know, what happens to people who make a promise to Jesus and then don't fulfill it? What happens to those people? You know, this is scary stuff. So I looked at this and I thought, my God, here's a man who's a billionaire. I mean, Pat Robertson has almost $1 billion personal net wealth. And he's robbing from the poorest people in our society and the most vulnerable and the weakest to give to himself. And he's doing it in the name of Jesus. Now, is that evil or what? I mean, if there's a definition of evil, that's got to be it.
And it's about as far from the word of Jesus Christ of Nazareth as you can get, too.
That's right. I mean, you know, I've been getting a little bit of Christian hate mail over this novel, and what I respond is,
which should be an oxymoron.
Well, I know it's very strange, isn't it? But very good point. But I respond to it. I say, look, you know, my novel is not anti-Christian. It's anti-fundamentalist. Now, there's a big difference. It is anti people who know. Now, you know, even the scientists get their knocks. I mean, we live in a wonderful, complex, and unknowable universe, and anyone who tells you that they know the mind of God, that's blasphemous, in my opinion.
We're talking to Douglas Preston, and his new novel is called Blasphemy. Well, let's talk about the scientists for a moment. They are the science team in your novel is led by a brilliant and charismatic physicist named Hazelius. Is he modeled on anyone in real life or in fiction?
Well, he is sort of. He's modeled partly after Richard Feynman, who is a physicist no longer here. We don't know where he is, but he's dead. But he was an extraordinary human being, interesting guy, and also on Robert Oppenheimer, sort of a combination of the two with a little bit of my own stuff thrown in. He's a physicist. He's brilliant. He's won the Nobel Prize. He leads this project. But he's a man who's disappointed. He's disappointed because he's got all kinds of ideas, utopian schemes, ideas about the world, the way it should be. And he finally achieves the Nobel Prize. He's the most famous physicist in the country. He's sort of a superstar of physics like Feynman was. And still, people do not want to listen to his ideas about the way the world should be, the way people should live in society, and so on and so forth. So he's a very disappointed man.
Right.
And I won't say more than that.
Is there any significance, just out of curiosity, to his name, Hazelius?
Well, there is. Anyone who is an aficionado of 19th century English ghost stories. I'm thinking actually in particular of Craig Smith. I hope he's listening. He gave me a book of ghost stories, and there's one in this book called Green Tea. And the main character in the book is a scientist by the name of Hazelius, spelled slightly differently. And I don't know, that character sort of inspired me. You know, it's the man, the brilliant man who reaches too far, who knows too much, and who doesn't stop when he should.
I was wondering how you, as a writer, are able to write this language, particularly the language of particle physics and computer, geekery. How do you vet it for authenticity, and then how much on top of that is from your imagination?
Well, that's a nice question. I when I was writing this book or thinking about it, I lived in Santa Fe and I had a friend who ran a scientific project up at Los Alamos, which involved a particle accelerator. So I went up there and he showed me the setup and it was really very interesting. He explained how things work. And when I'd finished the novel, I sent it to him and he pointed out my errors. Actually, there's still a couple of errors in there that I wasn't able to correct, but will be corrected for the paperback. But there are errors that only a physicist, only a particle, high-energy particle physicist would know. But still, I strive to be as accurate as possible. But it was very interesting to see how these experiments work. I did a lot of research also just on the Large Hadron Collider, what they expect to find, what kinds of experiments and research they'll be doing. I mean, I really wanted it to be as accurate as possible. And also the science of particle physics is fascinating. And these particle accelerators are looking into the moment of creation. They're really peering into the moment of the Big Bang. So it's not just particle physics, but it also has great implications for cosmology because they're asking the question, how did the universe get to be the way it is now? And, I mean, that's an incredibly profound question. That used to be a question that religion asked, and now science is asking it. And, in fact, science is asking a lot of questions that used to be really the purview of religion.
Like what else?
Well, for example, how did we get here? Who are we? That's the theory of evolution. It used to be that the religion told us how we were created, why we're here, why we are what we are, who we are, why we're in this particular image. But now evolution has told us that. The question of what is our place in the universe? Well, religion used to say that the earth was at the center of the universe, that we were sort of the apple of God's eye, and everything revolved around us. Well, now science has asked that question, what is our place in the universe? And it turns out we occupy no privileged place in the universe, at least physically. were, you know, a minor galaxy in the outer arm of a minor galaxy in the local group, and you know, with in the cluster of galaxies, and they're just hundreds of millions, billions of galaxies out there, spread out through a volume of space that is beyond human comprehension. That's what we know now.
It makes you want to be the captain of the Starship Enterprise.
Well, I've always wanted that. You know, I guess the best I can do is write novels about it. But, you know, these subjects fascinate me. I think about it. I mean, I will say this, that the universe that science is revealing to us now is far more awesome and beautiful than any universe invented by any historical religion. I mean, if you believe in God, this universe is far more flattering of God's power than anything that any other religion has dreamed up.
We're talking to Douglas Preston. I've been actually thinking myself a lot about the supposed gap between science and religion in the context of politicians saying to millions of people on television the words, "I don't believe in evolution," and trying to make sense of what that could possibly mean. Where do you think this hostility towards science on the part of fundamentalist Christianity comes from?
That's a very difficult question. I think that it's really a response to an extremely confusing world for a lot of people. People looking for certainty, looking for a rock of belief that they can cling to in the swirling torrent of our modern world. Why a presidential candidate would stand up on national television and raise his hand proudly when asked who here does not believe in evolution really blows me away. I mean, our country has to compete in a world where, you know, science is more and more important, science and technology, and to be led by someone who denies one of the fundamental theories of science. And it isn't just evolution in terms of how we got here, but the concept of evolution applies very broadly. You know, it applies to stellar evolution. It applies to the evolution of the cosmos. It applies to everything.
Well, it applies to bacteria that are actually used to make medicines that even fundamentalists do take.
Exactly. It's a denial of everything we know to be true. It's a denial of the modern world. Obviously, it springs from gross ignorance on the one hand. It also springs from a pride in being ignorant, a pride in believing something absolutely. And a person, you know, George Bernard Shaw said, I'm paraphrasing, I won't get it exactly right, so I apologize to those people who are persnickety about quotes, but he said, "There are thousands of human insects who are ready at a moment's notice to tell you the mind of God on any subject." And, I mean, that's how I feel about these people who deny evolution. They're telling us the mind of God. Well, I have very devout friends who are religious. I have a very devout Catholic friend who said to me, "Well, I think evolution is how God did it."
Right.
You know, you can't, you know, evolution is not a denial of God or religion or anything else. So why certain religions and certain people deny evolution is really beyond comprehension.
Well, I sometimes wonder whether it isn't, a desire to deny the idea that the world is fundamentally kind of random and mechanistic. In other words, that there is a material explanation for everything when we have, as human beings, by and large, a fundamental intuition about spirit, which really isn't explained by science.
Well, as a matter of fact, our feelings about spirit, our yearning for religion, our yearning to find meaning in our lives, I believe can be explained by science. I think it's a product of our evolution. In late human evolution, or perhaps not even that late, there somehow were genetic, you know, mutations that led to religious belief. And if you think about it, those groups, those tribes that had religious belief, it's an incredibly powerful survival tool. I mean, it gives you a purpose. It gives you a sense of self, a sense of group identity. It is a way to pass values on from generation to generation. Obviously, this is an enormously positive innovation in human evolution, which rapidly spread through the human genome. We are hardwired to believe. We want to believe. I want to believe. We all want to believe. Even atheists are fervent in their belief. It's just part of our makeup.
And at the same time, to believe that something that we believe fervently, it's that its genesis is mere adaptive significance as opposed to this is really the truth, I think creates cognitive dissonance in some people.
Well, you know, I would counter by saying, look, evolution is a beautiful theory, and it's amazing that a mechanistic theory that is so simple in its actual mechanism. I mean, you know, the theory of natural selection is extremely simple. There's nothing complex about it. Could result in the human organism. I think that's a miracle. That's incredible. And I'm not calling for intelligent design. I'm saying that it's a miracle in and of itself without calling on something unexplainable. I think that's very beautiful. I find religious shivers going up and down my spine whenever I think about that, because we are, you know, we human beings are a miraculous and strange and wonderful thing to happen on the surface of this minor planet at the outer edge of the galaxy. I mean, this is incredible that we can stand here and look out and peer into the moment of creation, that we have machines that will look into the moment of creation. I think that's absolutely extraordinary.
You write about science for The New Yorker and The Atlantic. Do you see among scientists an equal and opposite hostility toward religion that you see in the evangelical community toward science?
Well, I certainly see that among some scientists, a hostility towards religion. I think that their hostility, again, isn't towards religion per se, but it's towards the fundamentalists who are going to tell you what God thinks, and who also tell you, well, if you don't think this way, God's going to torture you. He's going to burn you forever in hell. I mean, and also the fundamentalists who are trying to influence their children, trying to force the teaching of religious beliefs to their children in our public schools, that's very offensive to them. But most scientists I know who study cosmology or particle physics have religious feelings for what they do. They have an awestruck, unexplainable, shivery, religious feelings for the subject that they're studying. It's not a mechanistic, you know, thing. They're not dry as dust scientists. These are people who look out at the universe, and because they understand it so well, it amazes them even more than it would someone like me.
The computer that, in your novel Blasphemy, the computer that controls the particle accelerator begins to malfunction. I don't think we're giving away the book too much to talk about this, because it does kind of happen in the very first scene of the book. Something goes wrong, and a voice takes over the machine, and you know, you might think it's the voice of God. The scientists think it's a hacker playing jokes on them, but it's a very rich setup that we have that goes throughout the book. Are there any inspirations from literature or film for this computer? What would you call it? Sort of being semi-alive.
Well, there. You know, anyone who is a fan of science fiction will immediately recognize this as a common science fiction plot. You know, the computer that gets so powerful that it suddenly starts speaking like God.
Right, in 2001, for example.
Exactly. I mean, you know, there are 100 novels like this. Now, I just want to warn, or, you know, assure your readers that the end is a big surprise, okay? You know,
right.
It isn't going to end that way. So this is a fairly common idea. What is maybe a little less common is the idea in my novel that science will eventually draw the curtain back from the face of God. That really science is a religious enterprise. It is an extension of our seeking of the truth, because religion is nothing more than a seeking of the truth, and that's what science is, except that science has a method of seeking truth that actually works. You know, the scientific method actually works, whereas revealed truth doesn't work, because here's the truth, it's just somebody who wrote something down and we can't change it. That's no way to seek truth.
What do you mean by work?
Well, because, you know, we seem to be hardwired to seek truth. We want to find out how things work. What is the purpose of the universe? These are things that we're seeking. You know, revealed religion has given us answers that all turn out to be wrong. Science is giving us answers that turn out to be right. I mean, science is the told us our Earth is not the center of the universe. Science has told us what our place in the universe is. Science has told us where we came from. Science is going to start answering the very biggest questions. What's the meaning of life? That's, you know, people say, oh, well, there's certain questions that are only religious questions that don't fall into the purview of science. Excuse me, science has started asking all kinds of weird questions, and believe me, by the end, you know, religion is being crowded into a corner, and by the end, there isn't going to be any place for religion at all. Science is going to ask all the questions.
So in your book, it's not only the science parts of the novel, but the rest as well. The Washington, D.C., the evangelicals, the Navajo reservation scenes, they all feel utterly realistic. How do you get inside these various worlds? I mean, I know that's what novelists do, but you do it very well. It amazes me. Each one of them seems so very authentic.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I mean, I guess I should reassure your readers that this is a thriller. This is not a didactic tome by any means. And, you know, these are real characters. I've just been fascinated by the what happens in Washington between lobbyists, the president's science advisor, politics, all this stuff that goes on, you know, televangelism, the influence of the Christian right. I mean, there's an incredible web of weird influence and strange, you know, bedfellows that I just found fascinating. I just had a lot of fun dissecting it and putting my characters into this scene and trying to get it all to work, you know, so that it really is real. And, you know, it's based, you know, anyone reading the novel will recognize people and events and things in it. I mean, it's not, I don't have to make up stuff in Washington. It's, what goes on there is so bizarre and so outrageous that, you know, you just take what's there and put it into a novel.
We're talking to Douglas Preston, and his book is called Blasphemy. And by the way, he'll be speaking at Collected Works Bookstore tomorrow, Tuesday, at 5:30, right here in Santa Fe. Tell us about your writing career. You started out as a writer for the American Museum of Natural History in New York.
I did, and then I started writing nonfiction books. I started off with Dinosaurs in the Attic, which was a history of the museum. And then I moved to Santa Fe, and I wrote Cities of Gold, which is it's a history of Coronado's exploration or search for the seven cities of gold. And as part of that, I followed his route on horseback with a friend of mine, Walter Nelson. And then I wrote a book called Talking to the Ground, which again is sort of a history of in Arizona. I took the Navajo creation story. I mapped it onto the landscape because the creation story talks about events that occurred in specific places, which left marks on the landscape. And I followed on horseback all over the Navajo Indian Reservation the paths of several deities that are in the Navajo creation story. And then I wrote a book about that called Talking to the Ground. So.
And you worked with Lincoln Child, who became your writing partner. What's the nature of your collaboration with him?
Well, we started writing novels together. Relic was the first one. It was made into a movie. What happened was, after I wrote Dinosaurs in the Attic, Lincoln was my editor for that book. Lincoln wanted me to give him a tour of the museum, and I did, a behind-the-scenes tour. I did it late at night so I wouldn't be caught showing an unauthorized person around. He turned to me and he said, Doug, this is the scariest building in the world. We've got to write a thriller set in this building. So we wrote Relic, and then we created some characters that we just really enjoyed and wanted to write more books with those characters. So we've written, I think, I don't know how many novels, 12, did you say, or 13? You probably know.
I think this is your 13th, isn't it?
13th, okay. So we've written quite a few novels together with our main character, Pendergast, who's an FBI agent, but sort of the opposite of Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. He's an FBI agent who's always in trouble with the FBI because he's not at all a typical agent. And, you know, our last book was called The Wheel of Darkness. But we enjoy writing these books together, although I have to say the writing process can be a bit stressful.
Well, what's that like? It's pretty unusual to have a co-authored novel, not to mention so many of them.
Well, what happens is that we plot the books together, and that's the fun part. We have a lot of fun doing that, although we argue and, you know, get into spats about it. We finally work it out. And then I usually start writing the first draft. You know, I'll write the first few chapters and send them to Link, and then he will rewrite them. And that makes me enormously angry. And so I will rewrite what he has written, and that makes him very angry. And we go back and forth like this, getting more and more pissed off at each other until finally the publisher says, hey, where's the manuscript? So So it's a bit of a stressful process, but it works because we both trust each other. I mean, I'll be writing and I'll think, look at this sentence I've just written. Has Shakespeare written a better sentence? I don't think so. Send it off to him, and when it comes back, that sentence is gone.
Right.
And I'm absolutely beside myself. Link, how could you cut that out? Doug, it was terrible. So we do that to each other. We cut out.
That's very funny.
Yeah.
But also, I suppose it's, I don't know, I mean, if people are working on, in their spiritual lives, on taming the ego, I suppose it's as good a way as any.
Yeah, and writing is sort of an ego, maniacal business, and you do have to, one piece of advice I give young writers is please don't be egotistical about what you've written. You know, seek out savage criticism of your work and accept it, because the only way you're going to get better. I've seen so many writers who are good, but they don't get any better because they reject all criticism and, you know, flat out reject anyone's opinion that is negative of their work. Because, you know, people are very, your writing is like your child, you know, you can't stand having your children criticized. It's the same way with your writing.
Well, and also people get into circles where the people who are criticizing them don't give them sufficient criticism. They'll just say, oh, that's great, that's really good, keep doing that.
Yeah, I mean, I've been in many writers' groups, and I've also taught writing, where the dynamic develops where everyone is just massaging everyone else. Oh, that's wonderful, that's great, you know, let's go to the next thing. You know, the writers that I've seen who are really successful are very hard on themselves. And they want to hear the negative stuff first. They don't want to hear, oh, what's good about it. I mean, everyone does want to hear what's good, but you've got your mother for that, right? You know.
Right, right. We're talking to Douglas Preston. So what are you working... Well, first of all, did Lincoln Child work on this book with you? His name's not on it.
No, he didn't. We also write novels, solo novels, and this is one of my solo novels. We actually do read each other's manuscripts, you know, the solo manuscripts, and give advice. And Lincoln gave me good advice about this book, as he did with my previous books, and I've given him good advice too, but... No, his name is not on it, except in the acknowledgments.
I was reading somewhere, I think it was in an interview with you about this book, that he blurbed the book and said, finally, Douglas Preston has gone too far.
Yeah, that's right. He wrote me a blurb that said, he's gone too far. I'm afraid he may burn in hell for this book.
So what are you working on now?
Well, I'm working on, I've got a book coming out in June called The Monster of Florence, which is actually a nonfiction book again. It's been a while since I've written a nonfiction book. But it's about a very strange story of a serial killer who haunted the hills around Florence, Italy in the 70s and 80s, and he's never been caught. And I lived in Florence for 4 years. And I teamed up with an Italian journalist, and we decided we were going to find the killer. And we believe we did identify him, and we went and interviewed him and asked him, are you the monster of Florence? And it was a very chilling experience. So the book is about that, is about the killings, the unbelievable investigations, our search for the killer, and then beyond that, we managed to offend the police who were conducting their own investigation, which was very different from ours. And one day I was walking down the streets of Florence. I got a call on my cell phone. It was a policeman. He said, this is a detective. Where are you? And I said, what do you mean, where am I? And they said, don't move. We're coming to you. And they came, the police, and they, you know, served me with papers. And I was hauled in for an interrogation, a third degree interrogation. It was something else. I couldn't believe it. Where I was accused of having committed a crime, including being an accessory to murder, obstruction of justice, planting false evidence, and I was then charged with perjury and a whole string of crimes. I'm still indagato in Italy. I'm still under indictment for a string of crimes. And my Italian journalist partner was actually arrested and charged with being the monster of Florence.
Oh, my goodness.
It's a most amazing story. I've never has there been a story like this. If a novelist tried to invent this story, people would laugh him out. They'd say, there's no way.
Right,
that would never
right.
happen in real life. So that book is appearing in June, and that should be kind of interesting.
Well, we hope you come back to Santa Fe, and we'd love to talk with you about it when it comes out here on the Radio Cafe.
Well, I'd love to. I enjoy KSFR very much, and I'm very happy to be on the air.
Douglas Preston is the author of 5 fiction, soon to be 6, and nonfiction books, and 13 novels. The latest novel is called Blasphemy, and he will be speaking about his new book at Collected Works Bookstore here in Santa Fe tomorrow, January 15th at 5:30. And Collected Works Bookstore is across the street from the Lenzic Performing Arts Center in Santa Fe on West San Francisco Street. Doug Preston, thanks again.
Thank you.
We're going to take a little break right now. Stay tuned to KSFR.
KSFR programming is underwritten in part by Locals Care. Locals Care community cards reward you for shopping and dining at over 100 locally owned businesses. You can support a Santa Fe nonprofit and earn rewards for yourself at any Locals Care business. Find program information and a current list of participating businesses and nonprofits at locals-care.com. Offered in cooperation with the Santa Fe Alliance and sponsored by Los Alamos National Bank, the New Mexican, and the City of Santa Fe.
KSFR programming is underwritten in part by the Santa Fe Farmers Market. The market now meets indoors at a new location, 519 Cerrillos Road, just north of Paseo de Peralta, on Saturdays from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. The indoor market features meats, cheeses, apples, honey, nuts, greens, tomatoes, root vegetables and other veggies, as well as baked goods, juices, jams, condiments, dried chile, and more. For more information, call 983-4098 or visit SantaFeFarmersMarket.com.
I'd like now to welcome Deborah Tang. She's from St. Elizabeth's Shelter here in Santa Fe. Deborah Bryant with the Center for Spiritual Living, and Gail Herling, who is with the Santa Fe Public Schools Adelante program. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having us.
So, Deborah, we had you on not too long ago talking about Mayor Koss's Blue Ribbon Task Force to End Homelessness, and we're sort of here for part two. Tell us what's happening in Santa Fe right now.
Okay, so we actually were talking about the 5-year plan to end homelessness, which actually just got adopted this last month. And so the next step is to actually enact the plan. And one of those, key pieces of the plan was to set up a one-stop shop where homeless individuals could come, get connected to services, and also have a place to stay. So in the daytime, it would be a resource center for them, and then at night they could spend the nights and stay out of the cold. So that was the goal of the one-stop shop. And we just had a meeting with the mayor and the chief of police and some other folks talking about starting that one-stop shop. And the mayor was very supportive of that. What we need to do now is get the city councilors to also be supportive of that.
Now, you've run into a little bit of not in my backyard attitude when you've tried to locate in certain places.
Right. So about a year ago, we actually had a contract with the owner of St. Catherine's School, a signed, notarized contract, to use some of their buildings out there for this overflow facility, and that didn't go through, basically because the neighbors supposedly were against us being so close to them.
So what happens now? Do you have a location?
No. When we met with the mayor, he was saying that we really need a business area rather than a residential area for this to happen. That probably would minimize the not in my backyard issues. But no matter where we go, we're going to have problems. I mean, people are going to not want what they consider a bad element in their community. So one of the places that we were thinking about was the old Albertsons in the DeVargas Mall.
Right.
Would be a great place, have enough space for us to do a one-stop. But, you know, we're concerned about whether or not the other businesses at DeVargas might put up some resistance.
What kind of a facility, in other words, how many beds, how many people you want to be able to accommodate on any given night?
we would like to accommodate everybody who needs shelter. And so it has to be big enough to have various sections. So like women with children, single women, single men, teens.
There's no category, you know, men with children?
If we had enough space, yeah, why not?
There was somebody who, one person died of exposure on Christmas Day.
Right.
Tell us that story.
Well, we do have, for a single man, which this person was, we do have the Salvation Army. The Salvation Army provides the space and we provide the staffing for overflow for single men. And so that was available that night, and it's just tragic. The person who died did know about that and would rather stay outside, and evidently there were some complications there.
Gail Herling, you're from the Santa Fe Public Schools Adelante program. What's that program?
The Adelante program works with students who are experiencing homelessness and their families, and also with children and youth who may not be going to school for whatever reason, who are identified as homeless. We provide all kinds of services ranging from backpacks, school supplies, uniforms. We have a food pantry. We do advocacy for these students. We link them up with services and do case management. We also have an evening program, a weekly program called the Juntos Project, where we have a free family-style dinner and donations of groceries and clothing and children's books. And we do classes for parents and art for the kids.
Tell us some, I mean, without, you know, names or specifics, but what are the stories of some of the young people that you work with?
Well, most of the children we work with are between the ages of 6 and 12. We also have many, about a quarter of them are age 5 and under, and then another quarter, I would say, almost, are teens. And a lot of our children live in very overcrowded conditions, not permanent, of course, it's transient, perhaps in a one or two bedroom apartment with maybe two or three other families. Some of them sleep on the floors. Many of them are hungry. We have, for instance, there's one family with three children where the mother has terminal cancer, and they live in a trailer, and they're unable to pay their bills most of the time because she can't work. And there's another family living with them of relatives. And these children also wind up with stomach aches and headaches, and they go to the nurse a lot because things are uncertain in their families. Sometimes things are chaotic, and they don't always feel like they belong to anywhere, particularly in school, unless they are getting some extra support and attention, and which is something that we try to do. We provide tutoring one-on-one, and that's a way we can form relationships with the children too. A lot of our children wind up being caretakers for their parents or their younger siblings, even if they themselves are very young.
And in need of care themselves.
Absolutely. A lot of them have, like, post-traumatic stress disorder. Some of them have, just like in the housed population, have mental health issues going on, and other medical issues going on, but they don't have the kind of access to mental health and medical services that their housed peers do. They don't have those kinds of resources easily available to them. And particularly our immigrant families, they have a language barrier. They realize there's some prejudice out there. They are frightened of being deported. And so they are dealing with even some further issues as well.
How do you work with the teachers of these students to let them know what's going on with these kids who have real problems?
Mm-hmm. Well, we get referrals from, we work with about 800 kids a year between the ages of 0 and 21. And so we get a lot of referrals of students from the schools, from people that work at the schools, sometimes from teachers. And Often what we do is if the student requires a tutor, then our tutor is in close touch with that teacher weekly, a couple times a week if it's necessary. And if teachers are worried about other problems with this child's life, because sometimes they will see it before we will, that there's a gap there or there's another serious problem, they will talk to us or they'll talk to the counselor. The counselor will get in touch with us and we'll try and problem solve that.
Let's turn to Deborah Bryant. You're with the Center for Spiritual Living. Tell us about that organization and your role in the Santa Fe homelessness problem.
Okay. In response to this need, there's been a collaboration between the faith communities, very much championed by Pastor Bethany Carpenter at Zia Methodist. The Presbyterian, Lutheran, Episcopalian, Jewish community, a mosque. So it's really been this interfaith alliance. And so while it's not our ideal, and we're holding a vision, as Deborah shared, for the one-stop shop, we needed to deal with, it was the end of November, so what we started at the beginning of December was a rotation. And so...
A rotation,
so that Monday through Thursday, there have been a rotation of churches who have had their space open from 7 to 7, and then my church, the Center for Spiritual Living, hosts Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. So that's where the Interfaith Alliance is collaborating with both.
And what happens on those days?
On those days, the families, the women and children, they meet over at St. E's, and then they're transported to whatever site is hosting that night. And then they, you know, have something to eat and they get a warm place to stay.
I would think that would be a problem too, just simply, not that our city is so big, but getting from point A to point B is a challenge.
It is, and that's why we have many volunteer opportunities, such as for driving. For, you know, we have volunteer opportunities for people to transport, to bring food, and then to help out at between the 7 and 10 p.m. time.
Deborah Tang, I would think that one of the things that is scary is the prospect of a downturn in the economy, which can, of course, happen at any time. I mean, things are bad now. They could be terribly worse.
I agree. And that always there's always the potential. We have been seeing an increase in the number of homeless, our homeless population, over the past few years. And it is. It's very scary that it's going to get worse.
Are you planning for that? I mean, how are you projecting? I mean, because, of course, your job is to think about what amount of resources you need this year, next year, and the year after.
Right. Well, the five-year plan is really kind of built to address that. Our goal is housing first, to try and move people as quickly as possible from homelessness. A lot of people are just temporarily homeless, and so it really is about speeding that process up, getting them into housing as quickly as possible, helping them with all the resources that they might need, whether that's a job or getting on assistance or getting disability payments started, that kind of thing. And so just moving those processes along so that people really are homeless for the shortest period of time possible. And of course then affordable housing and all of those other kinds of things play an important part in having enough housing stock in Santa Fe so that there is a place for people to move to.
And Mary Charlotte, I wanted to address this issue of not in my backyard, because for the last 2 years, we've noticed an increased need, particularly among families, for shelter. And as Deborah said, the homelessness is increasing. And we need to increase our level of awareness in this community, because most people think, well, I don't want homeless people in my neighborhood. We have homeless people in just about every neighborhood in Santa Fe, including the east side, west side, south and north sides. So they are trying to be as invisible as possible. They're scared. And so we need to be aware of that as a community. There are already homeless people around. They're not necessarily breaking into your houses any more than someone else might be. Also, who is homeless? The fastest growing population of homeless people are children under the age of 18, and the fastest growing population of that group are children 5 and under. They're not breaking into your houses. They're not walking around drunk on the streets. So these are people, even though they're more invisible than others, that are homeless that we need to house as a community. And I think also that there would be more of a police presence wherever there will be another shelter. There will be more of a presence of many agencies, such as the one-stop shop. There are going to be places like healthcare for the homeless, and the Adelante program would have a presence there. LifeLink would have a presence there. We'd be working with people directly instead of people wandering around looking for services. It would be a much more proactive way of dealing with things, and other cities have been able to do this and have actually found ways of collaborating between the homeless providers and the neighborhoods so that the neighborhoods become safer than they were before the shelter came in.
Say more about that. What kind of collaborations are you talking about?
In Albuquerque, there was a collaboration between
the hospitals and the homeless shelters and the service providers, including healthcare for the homeless. And they actually do an outreach that is a street outreach and really try to get people hooked into services and housing. And they're doing a pretty good job of it in Albuquerque. Of course, they have a different, their housing stock is more available for people who are at the very low end of income, much more so than Santa Fe has that housing stock.
But this idea of this outreach team going out onto the streets together, multidisciplinary, like a social worker, somebody who knows about mental health, someone who knows about the resources in town, that that's something that we want to do here as part of our one stop as well.
Well, unfortunately, it's time to go. Gail Herling, I want to thank you for being here. Gail Herling is with the Santa Fe Public Schools Adelante program. Deborah Bryant is with the Center for Spiritual Living, and Deborah Tang is with St. Elizabeth's Shelter. If people want more information, is there a number that they can call?
Absolutely. You can call me at St. Elizabeth's Shelter. That's 982-6611.
And you can call Gail at 467-2571.
And Deborah Bryant at 986-9500.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at Santa Fe Radio. My website is santafe.radiocafe.org, which is where the show is archived. That's where we podcast, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. My email is radiocafe@ksfr.org, and you can also leave a message at 428-1528. Thanks to Marilyn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, The Colors of Jazz. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We'll see you tomorrow. Ciao.